Deception by Randy Alcorn. This audio version is published by Oasis Audio through an agreement with Multnomah Books. I'm Roger Mueller. Chapter 1. Wednesday, November 6. My chest pounding like a dryer load of army boots, I knocked the noisemaker off its cradle and groped for it in the darkness. Three enormous red digits, 259, assaulted my eyes. "Hello!" The voice on the phone was deep and croaky. "Detective Ollie Chandler?" I nodded my head, admitting it. "Chandler!" "Yeah. You didn't answer your cell." His voice was a hacksaw cutting a rain gutter. "You awake?" "No, but you may as well finish the job." "In bed?" "Mowing the lawn. Who died?" I've been waiting all my life for good news from a 3 a.m. phone call. Many imagine that middle-of-the-night phone calls mean someone's been killed. I don't imagine it. It's true. Jake Woods tells me there's a God in charge of the universe. I'm not convinced. But if there is, I'd appreciate it if he'd schedule murders during day shift.
"Victim's Jimmy Ross," Sergeant Jim Seymour said. "Drug dealer."
I didn't shed a tear. To me, drug dealers are a waste of protoplasm.
"Officer Sason's the patrol," Sergeant Seymour said. 1760 Southeast Clinton, Apartment 34.
I scratched it down in the dark, postponing those first daggers of light. The problem with morning is that it comes before my first cup of coffee. I keep water in my Mr. Coffee, poured to the 10-cup mark with Starbucks French roast, always waiting. In my quest for maximum darkness, I load the filter to the top. Whether it's 7 a.m. or 3 a.m., I can throw the switch and, even though the world's going to hell in a handbasket, coffee's brewing. So there's hope. I pull the pot off the burner every few ounces to get what was there. I'd mainline it if I could. Trying to remember whether I'd had 3 hours of sleep or two, I put Mike Hammer, my bull mastiff, I call him Mulch for short, out to do his business. Every morning he acts like it's a privilege he's been waiting for all his life. After 2 minutes outside for him and 6 more ounces of coffee for me, Mulch blew open the door to get his biscuit. I headed for the bathroom, put my face 2 inches from the shower head to let the water pummel me. Presumably, I dressed, poured the last of the coffee into my 30-ounce mug, and said goodbye to Mulch and Mr. Coffee. It was early November, but felt like late December. Like a polar bear on ice, I negotiated the slick walk to my white Ford Taurus. You shouldn't assume I was conscious during all this. A detective establishes his routine so he can do it in his sleep. You wake up on the way, more at each stoplight. By the time you really need consciousness, it's usually there. You just hope it doesn't arrive at the scene after you do. The Portland night, nearly uninhabited, smelled of frosty rain on asphalt. Getting yanked from the netherworld in the middle of the night is the only thing easier now since Sharon died. I don't have to worry about her worrying about me. I turned on to Burnside. The moron in front of me just sat there in his lowrider, figuring since it's 3:23 a.m., he can chat with someone on the curb even after the lights turn green. I honked. Nothing. I honked again. The bozo charged out of his car. I pulled my Glock 19 and pointed it at his face. "Get out of my way, now." He froze, with a fixated expression of a man wetting his pants. He scuttled back to his car sideways, like a crab, and hopped in, banging his head on the doorframe. He turned his key with a garbage disposal grind, forgetting he'd left the car running. He screeched through the now red light. I flipped on my flashing red and blue grill-mounted strobes. He edged to the right, and I passed, with an inch clearance. Okay, maybe I should have identified myself as a cop, but many people assume that if you're a cop, you won't shoot them. I didn't want this guy to labor under the assumption. Having been a cop for 30 years, I find that you can get most of what you want with a kind word. But sometimes, as Al Capone put it, you can get more of what you want with a kind word and a gun. "Say, son," I spoke into the car phone. "Chandler, homicide. On my way. 1760 Southeast Clinton, apartments. Greenbridge Arms, third floor. Apartment 34 is sealed. Dozen people heard the shots. One possible witness.
Be there in 5.
When I'm on the up team, anybody who kills somebody does it on my watch. That means they're messing with me. And messing with me is like wearing cheese underwear down Rat Alley.
I pulled up to the Greenbridge Arms, studying the 4-story brick building. 4 criminals rushed me, armed with notepads, pens, electronic gadgets, and cameras.
What can you tell us, Detective Chandler?
The Oregon Tribune reporter brandished her notepad, poison pen ready.
Nothing. If you check your notes, you'll see I just arrived. They're denying us entrance to the apartments.
Good for them.
This was standard procedure, but reporters, thinking they're royalty, are outraged when they aren't allowed to trample a crime scene. I turned away as somebody snapped a photo. He grabbed the sleeve of my trench coat. I yanked it back. I turned toward him. His camera flashed out of my face.
I saw the red light of a television news camera right behind him. Images of my anger management class assaulted me. I'd never subject myself to that again. I smiled and waved to the camera.
Just kidding. Actually, I want to thank you folks for coming. We have a crime to solve and people's lives to protect, so if it doesn't inconvenience you, I'll be going up to the crime scene now. Enjoy!
The Tribune and TV reporters and their cameramen followed me to the front door of the apartments, where Officer Brandon Gentry opened the door for me. I signed his log sheet and wrote down the time. 3:39 a.m.
The TV cameraman opened the door, did a quick sweep with his video. As I stepped in the elevator, I said, "Officer Gentry, there's a van illegally parked. It has the letters KAGN on it. Would you please write a parking citation?" The door closed, and I tried not to ponder how the media, especially the Tribune, had been my judge, jury, and nearly my executioner 15 years before. I needed to switch gears to the job at hand. As I got out on the 3rd floor, I popped in a stick of blackjack gum, my crime scene entrance ritual. Entering apartment 34, I stepped from hallway to crime scene. There, sprawled in a death pose, was Jimmy Ross. 2 shots to the head. Physical evidence all over the place, with a bonus. A sealed Ziploc bag of ecstasy and a half-spilled sack of meth. No need for a lab report to tell me what was what. Cezanne told me the paramedic had come 20 minutes ago and pronounced Jimmy Ross dead. He was right. The medical examiner, Carlton Hatch, showed up 10 minutes after I did. Most ME's ask you to call them when you want the body removed. The ME may not arrive until 3 or 4 hours later. Not Hatch. Every time I've worked with him, he's come immediately, like an autograph hound to an NFL team hotel. Hatch is a number 2 pencil, head pink and bald like an eraser. He carries a man purse and wears a nicely fitted suit beneath a poorly fitted face. His pointy chin isn't a good match for his pale, bloated cheeks. Too much chlorine in his gene pool. I gazed down at my Walmart jacket over my shirt, spotted with yesterday's omelet. Considered my rumpled slacks, pockets holding Tuesday's Taco Bell receipt and packet of hot sauce, I looked again at the ME's tailored suit. "Tuxedo at the dry cleaners?" I asked him. His smile came quick and left quicker.
"Probable cause of death, gunshots to the head," he said, as if he'd drawn on years of training. 2 CSIs in forensic bunny suits arrived. 1 vacuumed, the other photographed. They collected anything possibly containing DNA fragments. I sketched the scene on a yellow pad. I supplemented with dozens of photos.
"Chandler!"
The loud voice startled everybody.
Barging in the door was my partner, Manny Domast, wiry, short, and high-strung, like one of those yippy dogs who starts the day with 5 cappuccinos.
Manny's grumpy at 10 a.m. At 3:48 a.m., the difference isn't noticeable. After CSI went over Ross's cell phone, I jotted down the numbers of incoming and outgoing calls. Manny listened to messages. He contacted 2 of the callers. Meanwhile, I talked with the wide-eyed witness in apartment 36. She gave a detailed description of a tall black guy with red sweatpants who'd been in the hallway 5 minutes before she heard the shots. Within 20 minutes, Manny and I determined it was a case of a drug dealer blown away by his competitor.
We found one bullet embedded in the floor, probably the second shot. Apparently, the other bullet hadn't exited. Fingerprints with blood traces were on the doorknob. DNA tests wouldn't be back for months, but I called headquarters to see if we could get a rush on the three good fingerprints collected.
It seemed so easy. Fingerprints and a good description and DNA?
That's when I should have suspected something was wrong. I'm saying this because the devil's in the details. Jimmy Ross's murder didn't require turning over rocks. Everything that mattered fell into place. What I didn't realize that morning at Jimmy Ross's apartment is that nothing was as it appeared. That case was open and shut, all right. Open and shut on a dead-wrong conclusion. And I fell for the setup. Portland Homicide has five teams, so Manny and I get every fifth murder. It was our next murder, the one 14 days later, that eventually woke me to a shocking truth that forever revised the story of Jimmy Ross and Lincoln Caldwell. That second murder turned me, my job, and my friendships upside down. It threatened to bring down a police department, end my career, and place me inside a white chalk outline with some other homicide detective trying to figure out who murdered me. If that's not enough, my investigation threatened to end the lives of people I cared about. And ultimately, that's what it did.